breast augmentation webinar. As many of you know, women of all ages choose breast augmentation for many reasons, but certainly either a lack of development or sometimes a diminished volume due to either weight losses, childbearing, aging, etc. Breast augmentation is the most popular cosmetic surgical procedure at this point. Since 2000, the numbers have gone up at least 35%. And again, this is reporting by the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, and I think that while I think their numbers are very accurate, I think there's probably a lot of underreporting because I'm not sure that everyone that could report their numbers for this do. But I would say certainly with the numbers that the American Society of Plastic Surgeons has, it's definitely gone up at least 35%. We kind of have a philosophy with all the procedures that we do, and I think obviously the oath that we all took upon graduating from med school, you know, do no harm. We want to listen very carefully to each patient's desires, and we also want to try to counsel people about potential negative outcomes. Sometimes if people come in wanting an implant that is way too large for what their body will safely hold, or maybe don't have adequate tissue to cover the implant, we want to make sure that, you know, the implants they're choosing are proportionate. And we really want to achieve the best result for each patient, and we want to explain, you know, kind of the thought process behind that. At the end of the day, we really want to try to make sure that we're meeting the expectations, but we also want to make sure that we all get there safely. And oftentimes, if there's significant droop, or fancy word for that is ptosis, a mastopexy or breast lift may be needed. And if it is needed, we want to talk about why and go through kind of what the process for that would be. Locations of incisions, inframammary crease, nipple areola, or the armpit, which is not shown here. Placement of the implants, typically, in most cases, I will tell you that we'll probably go under the muscle, which this demonstrates, and then this was above the muscle. Now, there's certainly good reasons for both. The reason that I usually recommend under the muscle is primarily, number one, better radiology. When the implant is imaged on a mammogram, it is white and cannot be seen through, so you're looking at the tissue around it. And if the implant is behind the muscle, when they take views from a couple of different angles, they're able to kind of move the breast tissue away from the implant better when it's behind the muscle. Second reason is, historically, when they first started doing breast implants, they put them pretty much all under the breast, or what we called subglandular, and when they made a switch to under the muscle, they found they decreased the rate of what we call capsular contracture, or hardening, by 50%. And third reason is, certainly, while saline implants are certainly not in number like they used to be, because they are filled with water, they tend to be a little bit more likely for folds and ripples that can be visible or feelable. By putting them behind the muscle was one more layer of coverage to try to help diminish that somewhat. The considerations for this, certainly we do these under a general anesthetic, so a person needs to be with good health that could tolerate a brief anesthetic. We're looking at less than an hour. We want to make sure that we've kind of gone through the size and the expectations with each individual patient. We do discuss symmetry. Most of us are not perfectly symmetric beings, and certainly we want to talk to each individual about their symmetry or lack thereof and how this will impact that. Sensitivity is certainly something that can be impacted, but typically is left intact. Breastfeeding should typically not be disturbed by augmentation. Bleeding is usually of a minor note. It's very rare to see much bleeding, but like many of our surgeries, we ask that people stop medicines that thin the blood a couple weeks before and after the surgery to reduce this risk. Certainly, infection is fortunately very, very rare, and we like to keep it that way by having people cleanse the skin in a special manner prior to the surgery. And then the scarring, which typically with augmentation is very, very minimal, small incisions that usually blend in very quickly. Issues related to the implants. Obviously, all man-made parts, whether it be a dental crown, a knee joint replacement, or a breast implant, may not outlast the recipient. You have to realize that with any man-made part, there's always a chance of failure. The manufacturers of the implants do a really good job of warranting their devices. They give one a lifetime warranty against rupture. So if at any point during one's lifetime the implant were to break, the manufacturer replaces the device at no charge for the product itself. In the first 10 years, if an implant were to break, the manufacturer would replace both the broken and non-broken device, and they would pay $3,500 to the cost of your facility anesthesia, etc., for the silicone or the cohesive silicone device. With the saline implant, they pay nothing at this point unless the patient has purchased a $200 warranty, which is available at the time or shortly after the surgery. And with the $200 warranty in place, if there was a failure with saline implants in the first 10 years, they would pay $2,400. As we alluded to earlier, the term interference with mammogram simply means that the implants are white on mammogram and cannot see through the device, so that you're looking at basically the breast tissue out around the device. And so for that reason, we have to take a couple of extra angles to be able to see all the tissue around the device. They call these displacement views, which is something that's very classically done with anybody with a breast implant. And as also we spoke about earlier as well, encapsulation, or what we term capsular contracture, is when the tissues around that implant, which are normally very filmy and soft, decide to get really tight and constrict around the device. If this occurs, it sometimes can give the impression that the breast has become very firm or hard. If that occurred and was problematic enough, it would require removal of the device and the scar tissue and replacement of the implant itself. About 3 or 4 months ago, the manufacturer added a new clause to their warranty which covers this. So for the first 10 years, if a severe capsular contracture occurs, the manufacturer will supply the implants required for replacement, and they do that for the first 10 years. And certainly, as we mentioned earlier, visible or feelable changes. Typically, the silicone implant has a very soft feel to it, and typically visible or feelable ripples and wrinkles are not as common. But with saline implants, because they are filled with water, oftentimes in a very thin person, you can actually see folds or wrinkles when people lean over or move certain ways. And those can certainly be appreciated a little bit more notably in the saline than with the silicone gel. And certainly if somebody is exceedingly thin, I think any implant may be felt or perceived slightly. 24-hour recovery is something that actually a fairly famous surgeon in Texas, Dr. John Tebbets, came up with. And basically, I think his point was well taken. There are certain things that we can do surgically to avoid creating a very painful situation, such as don't make the implants too wide for the girl, don't ding the covering around the ribs because that's got a lot of nerve endings and is uncomfortable, don't do a lot of blunt dissection, divide things cleanly with the cautery, don't let a lot of blood collect in there, and so on. The other thing was getting people up and moving. The idea is, you know, after surgery, instead of lying around, get up and walk, do some gentle range of motion with the arms. And we find that typically if people follow these guidelines, many people can be out to dinner the night of or out the next day. Certainly you're not going to be out there doing strenuous activities, but it's amazing most people can really be out and about. I classically tell people typically within 3 to 5 days, most people are driving their cars and back to desk jobs, and certainly we have some people back sooner than that. One of the things that's been kind of fun is using a 3D imaging device called Vectra. And this is actually a patient. Vectra actually puts the little top on the patient in this case. It doesn't on all of them, but this was just done for the purposes of this demonstration. But basically, it is showing what an individual looks like naturally, and then we can put different implants in that individual and show what they would look like on the right-hand side with the various implants in place. And we find that really helps to give people a good sense of what that implant will look like on them. And I think it also helps us be able to explain to people when we use the term cubic centimeter volumes, I think most everybody gets that, you know, how many cc's a various implant contains and what it's going to do to one's figure. But a lot of times people don't understand the difference between when we talk about profiles. You can have implants that are very shallow or very deep and projecting, and those are going to create very different looks. And so it's a very nice thing with this 3D imaging to be able to show you what you'd look like with different implants with different contours or profiles as well. And these are just some examples here. And they can, what's nice about this too is that we can kind of turn people in different directions and show what you look like from different angles and show you what you'd look like with different implants and different sizes in. The options, saline implants are the least expensive. They can be certainly identified very easily when they rupture. The body absorbs the water and they go flat. The biggest problem is because they do have some ripples and wrinkles sometimes, it's not always optimal for people with very thin soft tissue coverage. The silicone and the cohesive silicone implants have a very natural appearance and feel. The cohesive is a little bit firmer. With both of the cohesive and silicone implants, the MRI is the gold standard to determine if an implant has broken. The implants today are so thick and viscous, I tell people think kind of like gelatin maybe, that if they break, they typically just sit there. There's not any signs or symptoms. There's no particular illness or anything that people get. But the MRI is the best test to determine the integrity of the device. The cohesive at this point is on the market. There aren't really no more limited availability. At one point they were on a study. That study was concluded 2 years ago, and at this point they are available on the market. They are a little bit more expensive than the regular what we call round responsive silicone gel. This is an example of saline. They've been available since the late 1960s, and it is a silicone shell filled with salt water. It's exactly the same as the IV saline that we give for various medical reasons. An example of somebody with saline implants. And I think what I will kind of tell you is that as you look at these examples, to look at them, I don't know that I could look at a picture and say, oh, that's saline or that's silicone. I think you can get a great result with all of them in terms of how it looks, but I think if you were to feel that individual's breast, they do definitely have a little different feel to them. So some examples with saline. And then I think we'll have silicone gel. Again, this is one example of many different profiles. This was first developed in the 1960s. The first silicone implants were actually implanted in 1962, and it was the number one implant for a number of years, but in 1993, the FDA stepped in when all the controversy kind of flared about whether implants were causing problems. And so from 1993 to 2006, the United States limited the use of the silicone implant for cosmetic purposes. Basically, during that 13-year period, if you were here for augmentation, your choice primarily was saline. If you were here for any other reason that was reconstructive, you were allowed to get silicone gel if at that time you agreed to participate in a 5-year study. We were the only country in the world that did that particular limitation, and at the time they were limited, there was really no concrete evidence that there was any problems with them, but there was some suggestion in the popular media that they caused lupus and scleroderma, so the FDA stepped in and did the limitation. After 13 years of holding them in a limited use on the U.S. market, they reviewed all of the data, and in 2006, the FDA felt that they posed no significant risk and put the silicone gel implant back as a choice for the augmentation patient and all the other cosmetic purposes. Currently, at this time, they want everybody to be 22 years old, and they recommend MRI at 3 years and repeat it every 2 years to detect what they call, quote, silent rupture. At this point, we share the FDA's recommendations and guidelines. And I think, again, the big appeal of this device is it is very soft and natural. Some examples of before and afters. And again, I think as you look, it would be very difficult to put any of the examples that we have here next to the saline examples and tell you on a photo that they look wildly different. The cohesive silicone gel implant or gummy bear has a narrow top and a wide bottom. So if you could kind of set this up on its side, you could see it would be kind of a teardrop shape. They have kind of a textured surface because when you put that in the body, you want it to have a little bit of ingrowth or grip so it doesn't want to turn and have the thick part on the top where it would look unusual. It has been available in the United States under a 10-year study since 2001. It's been in Europe, I believe, since 1994. In 2013, it was approved for cosmetic use, and we have placed hundreds of these devices since our participation in the study and since that time. As I said, they're a little firmer, but I think once they've been implanted, I'd say the vast majority of the ladies that have these are very happy with them. A little bit narrower on the top than the bottom. Again, very natural look. But again, I would have a hard time telling you if I mixed our slides up without labels that I could accurately pick out the cohesive silicone gel patient from the saline or the silicone. I always say a well-placed, well-sized implant done properly is going to look great. I think it's a matter of just trying to make sure that you've got the right implant and the right size for each individual. And then, of course, execute the procedure appropriately. Occasionally, patients come to us and need a breast lift. Now, one of the things that I find that people believe that if you have a lift, you have to have implants, and that's absolutely false. If somebody has plenty of volume and doesn't really want any more volume, a lift alone works absolutely fantastically. But if somebody feels like they're volume deficient and also have droop, then a lift with implants may become necessary. This is an example you can see kind of classically after having children or losing a great deal of weight. The volume of the breast has deflated. You can kind of see a loss of fullness in the upper part of the breast. And it's kind of hard to show in this example, but the nipple has actually fallen beneath where the breast attaches underneath what we call the crease. And so in this case, we have performed a lift where you see an incision around the nipple, down and kind of in the crease, and added the volume back with an implant. And just some other examples of breast lift with implants. Again, if somebody is happy with their volume, they don't have to get an implant, but you know, in these cases, that's what we've done. And people have droop for a variety of reasons, sometimes after breastfeeding, sometimes after weight loss, sometimes just the way people are made. And so as you can see, that helps to restore the volume in the upper part of the breast and restores the position of the nipple. Every once in a while, we get called upon to help somebody with a problem. What this is demonstrating is this is a patient that came to us from elsewhere that's developed a very hard scar around her implant. And what happens sometimes, it almost kind of forms sort of a hard ball, and it seems to migrate north or up toward the shoulder. And so what we've done in this case is gone in, taken the scar tissue out, and replaced the implants, which you see to the picture on the right. This is an example that you can see of a deflated saline implant. You know, this side looks pretty natural and full. This side has lost volume up top. And what we've done is we've replaced the device to kind of fill that back up. And this is somebody that's had a deflation, but also has had a loss of volume and some droop. And so we've done a mastopexy as well as an augmentation to kind of get things back where they belong. Again, the examples on this could go on forever, but at this point I will stop and ask if there's any questions. One of the questions was cost, and again, the cost is driven a little bit by the implants themselves. The saline implants are $1,100 a pair if you include the $200 warranty. The silicones are $1,700 a pair, and the cohesives are $2,700 a pair. So basically, the price of the procedure varies only by the price of the devices. We don't charge any differently to put the implants in. The costs are the same. So I think the silicone augmentation is around $5,500 or something by the time you count facility, anesthesia, surgeon, and implants. And again, I apologize if that's up or down by $50 or whatever, but that's a fairly close approximation. The breast lift adds a little bit more to that because there is not only a little bit more to the surgery, but there's certainly more time in the OR. And I think we have some approximations on the website that kind of covers that, but I think it does vary a little bit depending on time and device. One of the questions was, how long do I have to be off work? And the answer is, I think most people could kind of manage this in a long weekend. You know, typically, as I said earlier, 3 to 5 days, most people are able to do desk job type of work, up and walking around. It's just that I wouldn't recommend strenuous heavy lifting for probably about 6 weeks. One of the questions was, does insurance cover this? And I would say, unless this was for some type of a reconstructive process, matching maybe a mastectomy reconstruction or something like that, in general I would say no, it does not. How long does it take was one of the questions, and it's a procedure that really takes less than an hour. I know that's hard to believe, but it's a very brief procedure, and most people spend about an hour in recovery and then they're home in the care of their designated drivers. Again, it's a procedure that most people find that they can recover from quite quickly. I think that is all the questions that I have at this point. I truly appreciate your kind attention, and with that, I wish you a good evening and remind us all that spring is coming. Have a good night.